KaiserNetwork.org.
Okay, let's go to show mode now. Go. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists, Susan Arnold, President Jakaya Kikwete, and Richard Stearns. And our moderator, Michelle Norris.
Good afternoon. Oh no, we're going to try that again. Good afternoon. Yes, it is a good afternoon, and it's about to become even better. It is such an honor to be a part of this discussion and actually to participate in the Clinton Global Initiative. We will have an opportunity this afternoon to put words into action. I hope all of you leave inspired by this discussion. We're going to be talking about bringing clean water and basic sanitation to families, things that we take for granted. Water has divided and united the world throughout history. It is the cause of war, yet it's also the symbol of life and renewal in most cultures and religions. Clean water is also a precondition for good health, strong families, and economic development. It promotes health directly through drinking and indirectly by contributing to clean food, personal hygiene, healthy communities, and stable economies. It is nothing short of the liquid of life. But worldwide, 1.1 billion people are living without safe drinking water. Tainted drinking water and scarce water for hand washing contributes to 3 million deaths from diarrhea, disproportionately affecting the young. And when sick children are victimized by unsafe drinking water, it keeps parents out of work. It also keeps children out of school, and that limits a child's development, and that contributes to a cycle of poverty, a cycle that repeats itself over and over again. Again, with this discussion, we hope to be able to break that cycle. You know, when we think about pollution, we usually think of pollution in underdeveloped countries in terms of smokestacks, big smokestacks, spewing out all that black smoke. But you don't necessarily think about fuel. Almost half of the world's population uses inefficient and highly polluting solid fuels, which means people are dealing with indoor air pollution. Fuels like wood, animal dung, crop waste, and coal are responsible for 1.6 million global deaths each year, and this problem is expected to get worse, much worse, before it gets better. Now, during this session, we will highlight some of the health impact of unsafe home environments, schools, and workplaces, and we're going to explore how to overcome some of the challenges facing these things. And to do that, we're joined by an esteemed panel. They are a diverse collection. They are all true leaders in their field. They represent government, the corporate world, and the world of NGOs. We are first joined, I'm going to do this beginning at the end, with Susan Arnold. She's a vice chairman of the Procter & Gamble Company. She works for the company that's ranked first in their sector of the Dow Jones Sustainability Index. Now, many of you may not know about that, but that means the company is held in very high esteem, and they've held that position for 6 years. It is a leading example of P&G's efforts in sustainability, and there is their focal philanthropy program, and also the Children's Safe Drinking Water Program. We're going to learn much more about that in this discussion. We're also joined by President Jakaya Kikwete. He is the fourth president of the United Republic of Tanzania. He's one of the youngest heads of state in East and Southern Africa. He's been a public servant for more than 30 years and a cabinet member since 1988. And to my left is Richard Stearns. He's president of World Vision. It is a Christian relief and development organization. It's dedicated to helping children and their communities worldwide by tackling major health challenges, including clean water and proper sanitation. And I want to begin with a question for all of you, and I'm going to begin with you, President Kikwete. If we all know and have understood for some time that clean water is so important, why has it taken so long to get government and corporate and NGO communities to really focus on this and make it a top priority?
Well, I cannot maybe those from the corporate will speak for themselves. But with regard to government, I cannot say that we we have not given enough focus to it, because if somebody asked the people of Tanzania today to list their priorities, their needs in terms of priorities, water will be number one. Mm-hmm. And as government, we have been responding to this to this need. We have allocated 10% of our budget is spent on water. And of course, so far the coverage has been over half the population of Tanzania have access to clean water, but the problem is still there. Of course, within the institutions or the corporate sector or the international financial institutions, at times the problem has been attitude or perception, rather. Because I remember at one time when I was Minister of Finance and we were discussing with the World Bank and the IMF on social sector strategy, their focus has been health and education. We were saying health, education and water. So I remember we were in Paris. I was in the sector that we were looking at the financing for development, but there were the others discussing the program itself. One official, I think, from the IMF came out of the meeting. He came and joined us. He says, "I left the meeting. I felt like vomiting because this man was talking about water, and we are saying it's health and education." So at times, of course, it's the attitude. But this attitude is now changing. I'm seeing a lot of awareness on the part of the World Bank, the African Development Bank, now the IMF, on the significance and the importance of water. Because if you talk about focusing on health and education, a sizable proportion of the diseases are waterborne diseases. So lack of clean water is responsible for diarrhea. It's responsible for cholera. Even for trachoma, the eye diseases. Because people don't have water, they don't wash their faces, they get the diseases. So I think there is increased awareness. Of course, for the corporate sector, it's investment. Water is supposed to be essentially a social service. And if you look for profits, water may not be a very lucrative business to do, especially in the poor countries. But of course, there is private sector involvement for water supply in the urban areas, where at least you have people who have the capacity to pay.
Now, Susan, perhaps it's unfair for me to put this question to you because PNG has in many ways led the way in helping underdeveloped countries provide more safe drinking water. But why has it taken so long for corporate communities to step up?
Well, I actually can't answer for others. I can answer for Procter & Gamble, where safe drinking water for children is a core focus for us and a core focus of our philanthropic programs. As part of this initiative alone, we've committed an additional $3.8 million to work with our partners to provide safe drinking water for over a million school children in Africa, which brings our commitment over the past few years to over $5 million on safe drinking water.
Why did PNG decide to make this a priority?
PNG had a product, Pure, which is a packet that is not just a disinfectant. You have it right there. There you go. It's not just a disinfectant, but it's a coagulant. And it takes things out of the water in addition to disinfecting it. So like arsenic and really dirty water, it gets in very quickly, works very well. We did try it as a commercial venture, and it didn't work. As a commercial venture, we couldn't deliver it to countries at a price that they could afford, and we could have just walked away from it. But instead of walking away from it, we said, no, you know what we're going to do? We still believe in getting safe drinking water out there. So we're going to work with partners in the public sector, partners like PSI, partners like UNICEF, and we work with them to provide the product at cost, and then we provide funding, and they provide awareness and access, and then we get safe drinking water out there.
Richard, I'm going to come to you in just a minute, but I just want to ask one question to follow up on that. I'm wondering if, in making that kind of commitment, if the act itself is almost as important as the money that you dedicate to this project. If that has a catalytic effect, perhaps on other companies.
You know, Michelle, we hope it does. Certainly, our employees tell us it does. Our employees' commitment at their morale when they hear about these things make them feel so good they want to do it. In addition, I will tell you that part of the funding that we've brought to the table today has come from our retired officers who have each personally contributed in a big way, and they've contributed over $600,000 to the program, which is terrific. So I think what you're saying is right, that people, when they see one act, it has a catalytic effect on other organizations and also individuals.
Richard, you've been raising these issues in the world of NGOs, but also in the corporate world before you made the transition. And why has it, the same question, why has it taken so long for this to rise to the top, to become a top priority for organizations?
Well, I think one of the real factors that I find in my work today when I go around and talk to people and I talk to donors and I try to raise money is ignorance. I think in this country, the United States, we take water so much for granted that we never even think, and we don't even think about it. And the people that I come into contact with are largely unaware of the impact of clean water, the lack of clean water around the world. Let me paint a picture. All of you, I could ask for a show of hands how many took a shower this morning, but I don't want to embarrass anyone. But think about the way you use water in your own life. You get up in the morning, you brush your teeth, you take a shower, you make a cup of coffee. It's involved with food preparation. You bathe your children in clean water. Your dishwasher washes the dishes after they're done so that they're clean and sanitary for the next time you have a meal. You wash your clothing in the washing machine. You water your lawns, irrigate your flowers. Now, I want you to imagine your family with no clean water at all, no running water in your house, and you have to walk 2 or 3 miles with a dirty old jerry can to get water out of a contaminated pond. And then you come back, and your children are drinking from this water, you're drinking from this water, your children are too sick to go to school, and even if they could go to school, they have to spend hours every day fetching water. You're so sick that your productivity is much, much lower. You're farming the fields, maybe, but you can't work because you're sick and you have these intestinal bacteria and parasites. The impact of clean water on a community, the negative impact of being without clean water, is just stunning in its magnitude. And if you could imagine your own family, now imagine your community, your city, your corporation or wherever you work, your organization, and imagine the United States of America without clean water. It is absolutely foundational to everything we do. But I don't think the general public is aware of that. Once people hear about the need for clean water and the impact it has on a community, we find it's about the easiest thing to raise money for that we raise money for. Much easier to raise money for clean water than HIV and AIDS, simply because it's so tangible and it's so fundamental to the human condition.
President Kikwete, I want you to continue to paint a picture for us, if you could. So many women and children in Tanzania spend much of their day collecting water, often traveling great distances. Could you help us explain for us what that means for them, this unfortunate but necessary fact of life, how it affects the quality of their life?
Well, the impact is big. My fellow panelist has just said, you get to a situation where there is no water nearby, and you have to go to a river. Maybe the river is several miles away. You have to walk to the place. You go and bathe in the river, wash. But it's the women now who bear the burden, because in the African traditions, it's the women who are the drawers of water and the hewers of wood. They have to wake up very early or early in the morning, walk long distances, and at times it's a very small spring that water comes out very slowly. So somebody has got to wait out for several hours before filling a bucket. And then after you do that, then you walk back home. She comes back home. She has got to the farm. Comes back. Take care of cook for the children, cook for the family. So it's a serious burden to the people in the continent. And it's a major burden to the women. Whatever we can do really to ease the problem of water, its impact is enormous. Because it's phenomenal. Because we got support. I think there were the Chinese who helped us with the water supply scheme. And when this was inaugurated, you can see the happiness in the faces of the people. I remember one gentleman said he had not seen water, tap water, for throughout his life. And to celebrate that, he took a bath at the tap. He said at least, he does not believe it, that at least now they have water. So I think it's one of a major problem. He said, probably because you take it for granted. But in Africa, it is a major, major problem indeed.
I have a quick example, if I could give it. I was in northern Ghana in April, and we went to a village called Boom Boom in northern Ghana. And this is a village that World Vision drilled a borehole about 3 or 4 years earlier, and we were coming back to see how the village was doing. And the wellhead is right in front of a schoolhouse. And I started to ask the women who were at the well gathering and filling their buckets with clean water how life had changed in Boom Boom since the clean water came. And they said that before the clean water, they would leave their village at 5 in the morning with all of the children that were large enough to carry water, and they would walk 6 or 7 kilometers to basically a contaminated water hole where animals graze and defecate. They would fill up their buckets and come back. They would not get back for 5 hours. It would take them 5 hours round trip to come. And then they would have to do it again in the evening. So twice a day, 5 hour trips, round trips. There was sickness. There was illness. The children couldn't go to school because they were fetching water. And they pointed to the schoolhouse and they said, 4 years ago, there were 45 students in that school. Today, there are 450 students in that school. And then they took me to the village and the women. This is a real gender rights issue as well, because when women are freed from fetching water, their productive capacity is unleashed. The women were making something that, Michelle, you might know about this, shea butter. It's something that you put on your face to make yourself beautiful and keep your skin young. I obviously don't use it. But they were making shea butter in their spare time, because I had time now, and they were exporting it to Bath and Body Works in the United States to generate income. So that's just a little story of the transformative power of clean water in a community for women and for children and for education.
Susan, is it important to not just provide water but also coach people on the importance and how to use it? Because when you do surveys in some of the villages, in Africa in particular, when people talk about the benefits of having clean water, they'll talk about ease and accessibility and convenience, and it makes it easy to cook. But one of the things that's lower on the list are issues of hygiene. So do you know, washing hands. And in a world of limited resources, if you have to make a decision about whether you're going to boil water for dinner or use that precious water to wash the hands after changing a diaper, dinner usually wins. So do you provide that kind of direction also?
And we do. So we have brands like Safeguard and Always that run educational programs in schools on hygiene, on safe hand washing. We reach over 17 million children, school children annually in countries like China, Pakistan, some of the countries in Africa, just with education awareness on hand washing, hygiene.
Mm-hmm. Richard, I want to turn that question around and ask you the question in terms of sanitation, because the same thing in the same surveys, when people talk about sanitation and bringing a latrine to the home, the first thing they talk about is status, not necessarily health issues. How do you change that paradigm?
Well, one of the things that's key to understanding in water and sanitation programs is there's a tendency for us in the West to focus on what I would call the hardware, drilling the borehole, putting a pump and a wellhead, maybe digging a latrine. But equally important is the software that goes along with that, because you've got to train the community on the importance of sanitation, the importance of clean water, the practices of hand washing and washing food and separating your animals, keeping your animals from where you prepare your food, in using the latrines. There are stories all around of latrines that were built that as soon as the NGO left, they became storage sheds for grain because the people were not accustomed to using latrines. So you really have to work with the community value system, and you've got to really program the software into them so that they have a greater understanding of the cause and effect relationship of sanitation and good hygiene to the health problems that they're having. And they don't realize very often that by, you know, having their animals in the area where they prepare their foods or not washing their hands after they've been tending to the animals, they don't realize that that leads to sickness and parasites and diseases that are literally killing their children. So the software is just as important as the hardware.
When you talk about software, we're talking about people. So you're actually talking about sitting down and
education. It's really education.
Communication. Yes. So how do you do that? How do you make sure that when you leave, when you build these latrines, and then when you leave, that they're actually used?
Well, in the case of World Vision, and I think many other NGOs, we tend to be present in the community for years. So we don't just come in and out and drill a well and leave. We're there for 10 or 15 years, and we're working not just on water and sanitation, but we're working on education and microfinance and food security and nutrition and other dimensions of poverty. So that education process, just like in any country, education is the key to escaping from poverty. And you have to first understand the threats and perils that your community is facing, your children are facing, before you can change the behaviors that you have that lead to those perils.
President Kikwete, clean water is not only a public health priority, it's also an economic priority for your country in terms of investment. And I'm wondering how much of an impediment is it toward investment? Is it difficult to encourage foreign investment if there are worries about the clean water supply? How do you make sure that investment flows toward your country if clean water isn't flowing toward your citizens?
Well, of course, when we look at the investment profiles of our countries, when we talk about infrastructure, we also include water, because if you have to develop viable industrialization, you need water. So where there is no water, it is difficult really to attract investments, especially in the industrial sector. So we have taken it as an important infrastructure development aspect, and we're trying our best. Of course, if I take the case of Tanzania, at least the coverage in the urban areas is 95%. So with regards to clean water in the urban areas, it's fine. Of course, the biggest problem is in the rural areas, where it is only 53%. But again, of course, even in the urban areas, we need to increase the supply of water if we have to have serious industrialization, because industries consume more water than the requirements of an individual person. So we have given it due regard.
The African Development Bank Group has given Tanzania $81 million to provide safe water. Officials from your government are quoted as saying, we're glad that money is coming, but it's just a start. What type of investment is needed to reach the goal of the millennium, the UN Millennium goal of cutting in half the number of people who do not have access to clean water?
Well, of course, we were looking at about 2.5 billion by 2015. If we get that, then of course we will be able to say that safely that we would be able to provide clean water 100% in the urban areas and close to 100% in the rural areas. Because water programs are very expensive in terms of development itself, investment into the infrastructure to deliver water to the people.
Susan, how do you measure success? What are your long-term goals with the investment that you're making?
Our long-term goals are in line with the Millennium goals of cutting down on significantly reducing the number of people who don't have access to clean water. And when you put it to very basic terms, over or about 4,000 people die a day from not having access, diarrheal illnesses, and our goal is to significantly cut that. Our product, Pure, which we provide, CDC studies show that it cuts those kind of illnesses in half, and our goal is to get it out as broadly as possible.
How is that distributed, Pure, throughout the countries that you're working in?
We work with partners like PSI or partners like UNICEF in emergency relief, but like in an example of PSI, we found that one of the most effective ways is to do it through school programs, school children.
I'm wondering if in some cases if there's sort of a series of unfortunate events that might happen, even with the good news in distributing products like this, and that where there's a lack of water, there's often sort of sub-economies that emerge between those who have access to clean water and those who don't. When you've worked in a community, is it important to make sure that everyone has access to this to make sure that you don't have to make sure that kind of thing doesn't happen?
Well, one of the things that happens is that we get the product there. We help fund it, get it there. Our partner like PSI would get it to a local, we call them mom and pop store, and they have it available at a price that the locals can afford to buy it. So we don't make any money. Mm-hmm. PSI doesn't make any money. And so in that way, we're able to get it there at a cost that's affordable. And so it doesn't become a question of have and have nots.
Richard, we've been talking about the UN Millennium Goal, which is to reduce by half the number of people in Africa who have access to clean water by the year 2015. While we're meeting here today, there is another meeting being held in Nairobi, and clean water is at the top of that agenda. And at that meeting, someone raised a concern that right now, they're nowhere close to meeting those goals, and there's a real concern that that it's a laudable effort, but they're not going to get there unless radical change is made. What changes need to be made?
Well, this is one of those areas where, as President Clinton says, we have the answers, we know the solutions, we just need the political will and the funding to scale them up. You know, I haven't used statistics today, but I'll give you one that you won't forget. You know, you could ask the question, what is the cost of providing clean water to an individual in sub-Saharan Africa? And the answer is roughly 50 cents per person per year. So it's 50 cents per person per year to drill a borehole or develop a water system that will last for 40 or 50 years with the investment that you put in. So 50 cents per person per year. I think we dramatically have to scale up the investment in clean water. Some economists have written that the next world war will not be fought over oil, it will be fought over water. And the political issues around water, where you've got the source of water in one country and people downstream depending on the water in another country, Egypt and the Nile is a good example. The politics of that region, because of the water rights, are very, very difficult and tense. And so I think this is a problem the world must face. I'll make one other bold statement there. There can be no poverty alleviation until there is a foundation of clean water. Try to imagine a community where you've alleviated poverty and the community is prosperous, but they don't have clean water still. It's impossible. So you have to do this first. You have to bring clean water first, and then and only then can development really occur.
Do you find sometimes that you meet forces, though, that might work against you, those who benefit from the current economy because they have access to water and those and others don't? And if you provide everyone with access to water, suddenly the bottom falls out of their profit center.
Well, I'm not aware of specific situations. I'm sure you're correct when you say that. But I think it's still very feasible. I mean, you've just got to change the nature of the way the economy in that region works. And my experience has been that no one is begrudging clean water to the poor. Those that have it celebrate it and take advantage of it. Those that don't are left outside the tent. So I don't get the sense that there's an abusive situation where people are trying to prevent clean water from coming.
I would like, with the limited time that we have, we've just got about a minute left before we move on to the next portion of our discussion, but each of you, and I'm going to begin with you, Susan, to talk about the greatest challenge that you face personally in the next year in trying to achieve these goals.
For us, it's really just staying focused There are so many good causes, and we get so many requests, and so many of them grab our hearts, but we need to stay focused.
President Kikwete.
The greatest challenge, as far as you're concerned, is lack of resources. If we get the resources to invest in the development and provision of clean water and sanitation, we'll be in business.
Richard Stearns.
Well, you know, we're a Christian organization, and on this issue of water, I think we need a lot more evangelism. We need to go out and tell Americans about the imperative for clean water. We have some best practice programs in different places in the world, and we very much need to scale them up and be part of the solution and take them into new countries and new areas where we're not currently present. But to do that, we need to really change the opinion of the American people and our donor community, as well as the U.S. government, in terms of the importance of U.S. water and grants in that direction.
Okay, our time is up for this portion. I'm now going to bring up Daniel, but before I do, just a reminder. For all of you, if you've been listening to this conversation and you have questions and you'd like to pose them to the audience, I encourage you to write them down and pass them to the facilitators at your table, and we'll try to make sure that we get to as many of those questions as possible. Now Daniel Stone is going to come forward, and he's going to lead us to the next path.
Thank you. So we've heard so far in this conversation how profound this issue is of the lack of sufficient clean water, sufficient sanitation, and especially in the developing world. We've also heard some examples of NGO and corporate actions that have been taken that actually make substantial contributions in this area. And yet we know that this is an issue that is still profound and slow to change, in spite of the fact that it can be dramatically affected for as little as 50 cents per person per year to provide clean water. So the question we would like you to consider at your tables and discuss with the people you're sitting with is, why do you believe it has taken so long to deliver on the promise of clean water and sanitation? And more importantly, what are actions that can be taken, including by people in this room, that could dramatically accelerate action? Now, the thing I would like to also say before you begin your table discussion is I've noticed a number of tables with 3-4 people at them. And we know that table discussions tend to be a better dynamic if we have at least 5 or 6 folks. So I'm going to encourage you that if you have a smaller table, to look around and join yourself with another table to get a larger grouping. Also, facilitator recorders, if you would please refresh your screens by pressing F5 until you get the correct question before you begin entering your information. And we will be back up with the panelists and the moderator in 25.
Well, I hope that all of you have had robust discussions at your tables. If we can get you to focus back up, so robust that we're going to have to ask you to turn around and focus back up here if you could. We're going to address some of the things that you talked about, some of the earlier questions that you passed on to your facilitators, and in just a bit, Chris Jennings is going to come up and sort of walk us through some of the questions and some of the themes and some of the gems that emerged from your discussion. I want to ask the first question to President Kikwete on the role of schools and businesses in providing clean water and sanitation to their students and their employees. How can these interventions help the community as a whole? What role do schools and businesses play in providing clean water and sanitation?
Well, of course, for schools, what I can say is education. For us, sort of for the case of Tanzania, of course, with the cultures and traditions, education will certainly help, as he has been saying, some of the problems that he has encountered in Ghana or elsewhere about the use of latrines. for example, we have a lot of nomadic tribesmen. Mm-hmm. These are cattle keepers. At times, I don't know what their culture is. Their culture and custom. They say, you cannot use separate latrines. So the cow shed becomes the latrine. So you say if you have the human dung mixes with the cattle dung, then you become wealthier. Mm-hmm. So if it's some of these cultures which we really have got to overcome. So I think education can play a major role in terms of educating children about sanitation and so on and so forth. What can businesses do? Of course, where it is feasible for the private sector to invest in the supply and the provision of clean water, let businesses come forward. Of course, as I was saying, in our case, we look at in urban centers where we can work with the private sector in the provision of clean water. Of course, from the businesses again, the innovation that they're going to do, creating new technologies, work with our governments, and if we can afford, we buy the technologies. If alone we can't afford, but we can work together with our development partners, we'd be able to access the new technologies. So this is what I can say.
Now, Susan, we talked about some of this in our earlier discussion, but members of the audience want to know a little bit more about the challenges and the impediments in actually working in some of these countries. What are the local barriers to getting clean water to urban and rural communities, and how can these be overcome by NGOs and donors and outside businesses?
Okay. I'll build on some points that President Kikwete has made, which is I think what we've seen in the past is the public sector at times has tried to go it alone, and on some level the private sectors have tried to go it alone, but probably the breakthrough here to barriers is when the public and private sector work together as a partnership. One of the barriers to that is time to work together to have common understanding, common goals, and trust. But the private sector, I think if you step back and look at it, what does the private sector bring? We bring, in our case, product, but we private sector can bring technology. We bring funding. We bring scale. And we bring business know-how. We know how to get things done efficiently. What does the public sector bring to the partnership? The public sector brings credibility, brings access. Ways to, you know, we can have pure, but I can't get it out there. They bring access to us and help get it to rural areas where the need is the most. And they also bring awareness and help with awareness and education programs. So I think the basic barriers have been cost, education, and really access. And I think by working together as partnerships, public and private partnerships, I can really see us overcoming them.
Earlier this week, First Lady Laura Bush was here, and she made quite an impressive commitment. And I'm wondering, actually the audience wonders, what the panelists think of the First Lady's so-called play pump water system to more than 1,000 communities in Africa. Is it possible to scale that up, to actually grow that commitment? And what are the challenges that you might anticipate in trying to get that project off the ground? I'm going to go to you, Richard.
Well, unfortunately, I arrived after the First Lady's speech, so I didn't get to hear it. But I think part of the issue with play pumps is you still have to have a well from which to pump the water. And one of the most expensive parts of bringing clean water is when you have to do the borehole drilling. But it's a wonderful, once you have the borehole there, it's a wonderful way to do the work of pumping the water up to a water tank that can service the whole community. And it takes kind of the labor element out of it, and the kids have fun doing it. It also can be incorporated into their education as well. It's a great entree for education in water and sanitation. So I think certainly devices like that and innovations like that can play a role. And yet you still have to find a way to scale it up and provide all of the hardware that needs to go in the ground to do it first.
Now, some of us are well-schooled on the subject, some of us less well-schooled. You've mentioned a term several times. What is a borehole?
Sorry. At least I didn't use an acronym. We love to use acronyms in the NGO world. Well, the water in places like Ghana and the Sahel region is hundreds of feet under the ground. You know, so you need a pretty substantial drilling rig that can go down, 200, 300, 400 feet to strike water. And once you've struck water, you have a well that will be productive for up to 50 years, and it brings the water to the surface. But to do the drilling, one of those rigs costs about $800,000. But once you have one, you can take it and drill thousands of wells and boreholes. So,
does it require a certain amount of expertise or technology to keep it running? Are you able to sort of pass the baton to the local population then?
Well, you can't normally pass the baton of the drilling to the local population, but they can easily maintain the well once it's in the ground. So there's a one-time cost. The way World Vision does this, I mean, we send these rigs out with crews of, 10 or 11 people. There are mechanics on the crew. There are hydrogeologists. You have to know where to drill and how you know when you're getting close to water or whether you're going to have a dry hole. So there's quite a bit of technology that goes with it, but our crews are crews of Africans. I mean, they've been trained, and they're engineers and geologists, and they travel around.
So it sounds like the technology is there. President Kikwete, I want to sort of expand on that with another question from the audience. They were wondering if clean water is primarily a technological problem or mainly a problem of finding the funding for existing technologies.
Well, it could be both. Of course, it's a technological problem because where for example you have a river running nearby the village, people walk to the river and draw the water. But where you don't have the river, but there is groundwater, you need the technology to drill and take the water out. But it's not a question of technology alone, it's a question of financing the cost of drilling. So it's a combination of both, and where both are available, then we feel comfortable that at least we'll be assured that clean water would be available.
Susan, beyond water, are there non-water-based ways to improve sanitation and hygiene in cases where water supply is inadequate?
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking me, but I think that one of the fundamental issues in improving hygiene and improving health through hygiene is education. That is one of the most critical ways to go, and I think there are times we even see that you have a well, and the water that comes out of the well is okay to drink, but by the time it gets used, it gets put in a container that isn't okay or gets used in some way. It is, and hands don't get washed; it gets touched, so that by the time it does get. People drink it, it is no longer safe. So it is certainly not just the water issue itself, but education is critical.
Chris Jennings is going to join our discussion now and tell us a little bit more about the discussions that you all held at your tables. Thank you, Chris.
Well, good afternoon. Really another very inspiring discussion, and certainly one that demands our focus. Water is the key on so many levels of everything that we've been looking at, and I appreciate the excellent presentations. And the responses have been equally impressive. I'm going to go quickly through them so we have an opportunity to respond to them. On the themes, we found a number of issues. One, that it was really critically important to raise the awareness of the issues in developed countries where we take it for granted. I think, as Mr. Stearns suggested, when people know about it, they feel motivated to do something about it, but we need to do a better job of raising awareness. Secondly, create local ownership structures to ensure local and political investment in clean water. This is the point that we've heard throughout the infrastructure discussion and every single session, that this must be local and there must be local investment in the answers of infrastructure. Thirdly, that there was some people in the room who said that we need to talk about maintenance of wells as well as drilling and going beyond, because that's as critically as important and has been a problem in years past, when once we have gone and invested, we haven't gotten the return on those investments later on, or they've gotten into disrepair, which I think is also plays into the issue of local investment as well. Going on to the next slide, policies need to account for where people live and work. This point was really stated about how many people who work in Africa don't necessarily and live there. When they work, they go for far distances, so sometimes their water access points are in very different places. So remembering that one access point doesn't take care of all access points, and you have to think strategically and follow migration patterns as accordingly. The next point was that no one seems to really own the problem, or at least there was a perception that no one seems to sufficiently own the problem, and therefore isn't necessarily held, any individual one is not held accountable to achieve results. And then lastly, often the poorest, ironically enough, pay the highest for their water. Those were raised in a number of different ways. The nuggets, I have to say, we didn't have as much answers as we had problems and themes. The first one was there was no Lance Armstrong for water. We'll ask you, Michelle, how we respond to that. Give bikes to women and children fitted with special water containers. This was a point about transporting water and making it easier to transport water, even when you don't have the wells in place. Create a higher focus on dry sanitations where you don't have water, because obviously that has made significant contributions to the problems. And lastly, there seemed to be a sense in this last point that there doesn't seem to be enough coordination between the agriculture sectors and the healthcare sectors, and understanding how they're so interwoven about potential problems as a consequence. So that is our conclusion from obviously a very, very knowledgeable group of people. And then I will ask the panel to respond, if I may. Thank you.
You've given us good fodder here. I want to begin with the Lance Armstrong observation. There's no Lance Armstrong for water. Would that make a difference if someone like Angelina Jolie or someone like that, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, made this a priority, and there was, you know, a very public campaign to raise awareness on this issue. Would that make a difference?
Well,
you know, do we need an Oprah Winfrey of water?
Yeah, I think it would. I mean, you mentioned Oprah Winfrey. She's done a marvelous job of drawing attention to HIV and AIDS, to the problems of women in Africa, to, you know, female genital mutilation, and a number of these other issues that we face. So when someone of her stature gives attention to an issue, it really does make a difference. And even the funders in Washington sometimes watch Oprah and watch those shows, and they realize that all their constituents are watching as well. So
I mean, they're watching Oprah, not listening to All Things Considered? Because they air at the same time.
In the morning when they're shaving, they're listening to All Things Considered, you know. But I think celebrity, you know, I'm on the board of the One Campaign, which has really been something Bono and now the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are supporting. And that's a multifaceted effort to draw attention to all of the Millennium Development Goals over time, and using celebrities and media corporations to assist. You know, we're working with people like Google and Yahoo, and obviously celebrities like Brad Pitt and Angelina and all of Bono's buddies. Over time, that's going to be tremendously important. We listen to celebrities. I don't know why, but we do.
Susan, you know, this observation about bikes for women and children fitted with special water containers. And I was wondering if there are other kinds of products that corporations might help develop with this population in mind, whether it's, you know, those sort of instant water purification systems that are so small that you can carry them on your back, or the kind of camel systems, if you run, you might be familiar with this, that you can carry on your back that has the little sort of mouthpiece that you can run a marathon and, you know, take a sip of water or Gatorade or whatever. Is that on the drawing board? Is that the kind of thing that we might see in the future from the corporate world?
Again, you know, I can't answer for the entire corporate world. I can only answer for our corporation. And we have a product now that really our focus is on getting it out to more people, rather than developing a new and different product, bringing costs down, mm-hmm. getting it available, getting it scaled up, and getting it out. I am sure that other corporations who make things like bikes have things like that on their agendas, but our agenda, we're really a consumer products company, and we've got a product that we just need to get costs down and get it out.
Richard, would that make a difference, having sort of the right equipment to carry the water from point A to point B?
Well, the problem is when there's no clean water to begin with. So if they're going to fetch dirty water, which is usually the case in Africa when they're walking multiple kilometers to get water, it's bad water that they're fetching. So it would be putting a not even a Band-Aid on the problem. It would save a little time perhaps. But you know, you have to get at the root cause. You have to get at the root problem. One other thing I would mention, I think we've given the impression that there's only one approach to bringing clean water, drilling deep hole wells, and there really are very multiple approaches. The product that Procter & Gamble makes, Pure, is a perfect product for areas where boreholes are not possible. Mm-hmm. I was in a community just a few months ago where we drilled 12 boreholes and they were all dry. And the people were literally in tears because they couldn't get clean water. A product like Pure would be a solution for them that is otherwise not available. There are also water catchment systems where you can teach people to catch rainwater as it comes off their roof and pipe it into the ground into a cistern, and then they can draw on that water. They collect it during the rainy season, and they can draw on that water. So there are many innovative and clever ways to do clean water programs. It really depends on the geology and the climate of the place that needs the water.
President Kikwete, the observation that there needs to be a better partnership between rural agriculture and health services to maximize the dual use of water, and I'm wondering if you foresee this kind of thing, and if there are also opportunities within government to find ways to educate people about pesticide runoff. And when you were talking about the nomadic cattlemen and, you know, some of the things that they believe which will enhance their business but certainly doesn't enhance the health of their communities.
Well, of course, there is need for partnership. But I would add between water, rural agriculture, and health services. Yeah, because in many of our governments or in many of our countries, there is a department that's responsible for water. So you need that, because it is this department responsible for water that that is doing the allocation of water rights. So even for somebody who wants to use water for agriculture, from a river has got water rights, as he was saying, because those who are upstream may take all the water and deny those who are downstream, the river. So I think the partnership is water, agriculture, and health services. I have no problem. This is fine.
Now, the observation in this room is that no one owns the problem. Not the health ministry, the public works, social communities, private sector, and that therefore no one is held accountable. Now, how is this seen in Tanzania? Who, when they talk about the lack of clean water and the lack of sanitation, when they're looking for blame or accountability, to whom do they point?
No, it must be the Department of Water, because we have a Minister of Water. It has been there for many years. Since British colonialism, since structure, there are hydrologists, there are people who are in the construction and drilling of wells, there are people responsible for construction of dams, and so on. So I think to say that there is nobody who owns it, I don't think is quite correct in the case of Tanzania. There is a department that is responsible and answerable on issues related to water supply.
Mm-hmm. So the view there is different than the view in this room?
Yes.
The maintenance of wells. Richard, you talked about building wells, and we talked about passing the baton. You build a well, you expect that it can work for 50 years, but we all know that technological systems, mechanical systems break down, and they need to be fixed. What happens when these wells break down? What are the maintenance issues?
Well, I think whoever wrote that comment, there have been horror stories in the past of well-meaning organizations that will go and they'll put in some high-tech solution and leave. And what I said earlier about hardware and software, you know, the software, the education part is critically, critically important. And we intentionally use very low-tech pumps. We don't use electric pumps. We use low-tech hand pumps. And we go to great lengths to train. We form a water committee in the community, and we get groups of people together and train them on well maintenance and how to repair wells. We use standard parts that are available in the country. We actually try to make sure there's a market for those parts in the country so that the replacement parts can be gotten. So it is critical that whatever intervention you bring, that it be culturally appropriate and possible to maintain by the community on a sustainable basis. And if you don't do that, you've really done very little good, because obviously the pump won't work. Mm-hmm. So that's important. That's the software education part.
How common is that problem, wells breaking down? How reliable are they? What's the frequency of repair?
Well, I don't have any statistics. I think they're quite reliable, and I think most NGOs today are no longer making those mistakes in their programming. I think we become sophisticated enough as a community that we understand this well from the errors of the 60s and 70s, perhaps. But I don't think it's that common, and when it does break down, it's a very simple device with just a few moving parts, and it can be repaired.
Susan, I want to ask you about the PNG experiment. Often when you get started on a project, you head down one path and you realize, well, it's not exactly right, and you make adjustments, and by about the third or fourth year, you finally have it right. What lessons did you learn in the early going?
Well, the truth of the matter is, in the early going, we tried to do this. We tried to get Pure out there through our typical systems, and we realized that we just didn't have the credibility, the access, really the access for broad distribution to get it to the people who needed it in a cost-effective manner. And so we had to come back and form partnerships and team with partners who have that access to try and get it out.
And in that period, was there ever any questioning within the company of whether you should pull back? Was the commitment there, rock solid commitment there all along?
I just wasn't working on it then. So I'm honestly not knowledgeable mm-hmm. about the past.
All right, well, I'm looking down and I'm seeing three zeros, and that means that this portion of the conversation is finished. We're going to hear now from Donna Shalala, and she's going to tell us about some of the wonderful commitments that were made. And as she heads up here, I want you all to think about some of the things you've heard here. This whole conference is about taking conversations and turning it into action, taking those conversations and turning them into commitments. And so if you are at all inspired by what you've heard here today and you have not yet filled out your commitment, perhaps you now have inspiration and some ideas for that. So, Donna?
Ladies and gentlemen, Donna Shalala.
These are the hearty souls. Please welcome back up on the stage Susan Arnold, the Vice Chair of Procter & Gamble, and Peter Clancy, the President of PSI, which is the global marketing firm that she referred to. As Susan has already told us, P&G will provide its per purified water technology at cost to schools across sub-Saharan Africa and four other countries. The impact is 1 million African children, about 35 million liters of water. And as she's already indicated, the total commitment in terms of dollars is $5 million, given what they've already done and what their new commitment is over a three-year period. And let's congratulate P&G. Thank you very much. Photo opportunities. Thank you. Please welcome Julius Coles, President of Africare. In five African countries, they will provide HIV/AIDS-affected households with home-based services, including improved water, sanitation, and hygiene. The commitment is $2 million over 2 years.
Thank you.
Julius, it reminds me, years ago I was sitting in an African village with a college classmate, and we were talking about the women's movement and what an impact it had around the world. And her grandmother came up and had overheard our conversation, and she said, for me personally and my generation, that well is our freedom and our liberation.
That's very true.
Tom Miller from Siemens. Where's Tom? Siemens. Through the provision of water purification technologies and medical diagnostic equipment, including scanners and ultrasound and x-ray devices, Siemens is actually going into a very rural area of China that does not have these kinds of this kind of equipment, and provide it. The commitment is $10 million over 5 years. They're going to develop using their very advanced technology, they're going to develop a model that can be used in other places in the world. Siemens, of course, is an extraordinary technology company, and it's a wonderful commitment. Final commitment, let me invite Seth Wall, the CEO of Deutsche Bank, and the spectacular Bill Drayton, the chairman and CEO of Ashoka. Oh, Catherine's coming up. Is there a last name? Catherine Bond. This is a very interesting project. As you probably know, three-fourths of the new cases of blindness every year are treatable and preventable. And in the developing world and in the near developing world, and Bill, correct me if I don't have this right, many of the eye clinics are actually very close to being self-sustaining. However, they don't have the resources to expand or to introduce new technology. And this project around the world will provide both the financing for the expanding of the physical plant, new equipment and training, and work with these clinics to develop a business model that will make them self-sustaining. So it combines the best of the private sector with the kind of social entrepreneurship that Ashoka is so famous for, with all sorts of other partners that they've put together. The total commitment is $20 million over 6 years. You'll probably get some of your market back. At least it'll be near market returns, but it's a model that can be repeated once this platform is set up for a whole set of other kinds of health-related issues to make them self-sustaining To expand the role of private sector financing to help expand the quality of healthcare around the world. So let's congratulate our colleagues. How'd I do? Did I get it? Thank you very much.